Welcome to the We Have a Meeting podcast, where we sit down with the world's smartest thinkers to give you the actionable tools, insights, and strategies that could make your life more impactful and productive. This week, we have a meeting with...
So today we are joined by an influential leader in the world of sales. He's worked his way through the ranks of sales and continues to motivate and influence others on LinkedIn with his helpful insights and leading sales podcast, 30 Minutes to President's Club. Recently named on LinkedIn as a sales insider, not only is he an array of knowledge when it comes to all things selling, he's also my secret LinkedIn man crush. Ladies and gentlemen, Nick Sigelski. How are you, Nick?
Well, you make me sound much, much smarter and much, much better looking than I actually am, Jack. So hopefully via this podcast, we dispel one of those beliefs. People can't see me, so they don't know if I'm bad looking or good looking. But maybe they'll determine if I know what I'm talking about via this episode.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Nick, kind of, I started using LinkedIn at the start of the year, and you were somebody that popped up on a regular basis. And what I found on LinkedIn is the best way to get traction was obviously using sarcasm and kind of calling people out on behavior. If it wasn't, it was like, this is my way of thinking. And it's maybe a stupid British way, but it was like questioning and provoking others to kind of have interesting debates and things like that. And we have had some interesting debates on different topics, and I'm sure we're going to get into those later on. But before we do, can you talk us through where it is, where you're at the moment, what you're doing, what your focus is in the world of sales?
Sure. So my background has been software sales. Most of my career, I spent selling really exciting accounting software to a really exciting industry, law firms. So most of my career, I spent selling accounting software to law firms. And a couple of years ago, I started a sales-focused podcast called 30 Minutes to President's Club, where we talk about things that salespeople can do, say, or write. And that's it. We don't talk about mindset. We don't talk about work ethic. We don't talk about mental health. All of those things are super, super important, but they're not the focus of the show. We started the show so that I could upskill and get better as a salesperson. And that show has gotten quite popular, and now I've transitioned to doing that full time. But never fear, I am still selling because I'm responsible for all of our ad and partnership sales. So I went from selling to law firms, selling software, to now I'm selling a sort of different thing. And it's a little bit of like founder-led sales because I'm the guy who owns the thing. So if somebody wants something really custom, I guess I can do it. But the good news is I'm doing as much as possible to not just become a talking head who's like, look, I'm a really big sales influencer, haven't sold in a decade, but that's what I'm doing now.
Okay. And why do you think the podcast, and I've listened to a few episodes. I know earlier I mentioned that I love to say your name, Nick Sigelski. I think it's a great name. I also like to say the name Jeb Blount. I think that's a brilliant name. Jeb, true or false, Jeb Blount. And I listened to a couple of his episodes with you. Why do you think the podcast has been so successful?
I think we have a ruthless focus on the angle of the show and the thing that is actually valuable about the show. I think most sales podcasts, they invite somebody on and they spend the first 12 minutes saying, Nick, how are you doing today? And I say, oh, it's great. We're having some nice weather. I'm feeling good. Oh, tell me about your backstory. Well, I grew up as a child, as a potato farmer. And, you know, they sort of meander and ramble. And it takes a while to get to the stuff that people are actually interested in hearing. And if you think about why folks listen to a sales-focused podcast, there's so many other things that you could be doing with your life, right? You could be at the pub with your friends. You could be going for a run. You could be spending some time with your family. So if you're taking time to listen to something related to your career, it's not to hear about some random guy in California's weekend. They want people listen to the show because they want to get better and they want to get better quickly. And so part of the reason I think we've gotten popular is we will record with the guest for an hour and we only publish 30 minutes of the interview. We only publish the stuff that is like immediately usable and actionable and somebody can steal and take and put into practice right away. And so we've had a really, really strict focus on that, which sometimes requires like hard decisions where it's like we've had to re-record with many guests where it's like, hey, like, That episode was not good enough. We can't publish that. And we say it a little bit nicer than that. But I think the focus of the show is so, so narrow that it actually, that constraint gets the best out of people.
So now that I'm digesting podcasts and recommending them to our new salespeople, if I was to say, get Nick's podcast on, what's the perfect first episode that kind of gives a flavour for what you do, but also maybe for like a new salesperson that's kind of breaking into the space? What would you recommend as the best first episode?
We actually recorded episode zero to address just what you said, Zach. Episode zero is 5 minutes long, and it tells the listener three actionable takeaways. It tells them why they might want to listen. It also gives some reasons why you might not want to listen, why it might not be for you. And then the listener can decide after 5 minutes, three if you play it on 1.5 speed, or maybe that's 2x speed. I'm horrible at math. whether or not they want to continue with us.
Okay. So I've listened to a few. I tend to do that thing that we all do of I pick on the ones that that adhere to my biases. So I've listened to like you've had Keenan on a few times, right? Yeah, I've listened to those ones. You also had a Sandler guy on who I really liked. I think I listened to that one maybe like 3 times on a dog walk. But what would you say, no matter who you speak to within sales, whether it's those two viewpoints or someone who sits on the complete opposite side of the fence, what are kind of the commonalities throughout that you started noticing? Actually, no matter who you are, this comes up as important every single time.
Yeah, I think the biggest one that has emerged through almost 3 years of doing this is that the best salespeople, the foundation for everything that they do comes from the perspective of how do you help the customer achieve the optimal outcome, irrespective of the thing that you sell. And when that is the paradigm through which you're viewing everything, your behavior starts to match. And like, there's this stigma you almost have to overcome as a salesperson in every single interaction you have with a customer, where they have a preconceived notion of what a salesperson is. They think you're there to swindle them or reach into their pocket or trick them into buying. And that really isn't the case if you're a professional salesperson. And so you almost have to artificially overcorrect in the direction of signaling things where it's like, hey, like, my job is to help you achieve the optimal outcome, whether or not that's my thing or not. And so there's lots of ways that gets put into practice, and I'm happy to talk about some of the specifics. But I think if you look at like the foundation of what I've heard from the best salespeople, that is what drives all of their behavior.
And was there like, obviously, what we've learned by having these kind of like people in the industry, it's like one-on-one coaching. You're having a therapy session on a podcast, which is the same as like a sales session, but it is like a bit of you're teaching your audience that are listening. But I imagine that obviously it's someone that works in sales as well. You're not just this presenter, hunky wrestler guy. You're still learning in the same sense, Nick. Was there like a penny dropping moment where someone's come on, said something and thought, bloody hell, I wasn't prepared for that. I didn't really know that.
Yeah, the biggest like sort of tool that I learned was we had a guy, his name's Charles Mulbauer. He lives in New York City. And he came on the show and he talked about what he calls the humbling disclaimer. And the humbling disclaimer is simply when you are asking the customer a hard or a maybe vulnerable question. Most salespeople struggle to ask very, very direct or hard or vulnerable questions. Like, let's say, Jack, you and I have had a number of meetings, and it's getting to the point where it's like, I'm thinking in my head, like, is this guy just kicking the tires, just like exploring and he's never going to buy, or is he actually serious about buying this thing? And I might need to actually ask you that question at some point. And most salespeople, especially in the US, like, it's hard for me to be like, so Jack, are you going to buy or not? And what Charles taught me, or like, let's say we're in a competitive deal and I want to understand who the different competitors in that situation are. Sometimes it can feel a little awkward to just go to the buyer and be like, so who else are you talking to? What other competitors are you speaking with? And the idea behind the humbling disclaimer is you take the sort of the reservations or the hesitations or the fears or the worries that are in your head, and you actually just disclaim or preface your question with that. And so I might say, Jack, I feel a little awkward asking this, or I feel even a little uncomfortable asking this, but we've had a couple conversations, and I guess I'm curious, do you feel like this is something you're going to buy? Mm. The difference between... Yeah, go ahead.
Is it Sandler? Is it
I think it comes from the book that Charles cited where he learned it was a book called Question-Based Selling, which might have some roots in Sandler. He will be the first one to tell you he didn't come up with it, but I think he teaches it really well. And I particularly like it because I'm not great at asking direct and hard questions. And you can part of the reason I loved this one is you can have a little bit of fun with it also, where you can be like, man, I actually used this to negotiate a purchase of real estate in the United States. So Armand, my podcast co-host, and I own some rental property together. And literally the week after we had that episode where we talked about the humbling disclaimer, we were in the process of buying a small apartment building. And we started to use the humbling disclaimer to negotiate the deal. And we ended up negotiating like $200,000 off the purchase price of this place. So I'm like, the podcast has made me some money, you know, indirectly. But I love that. That for me, I didn't really understand it before. And so, like, I used to lose a lot of sleep as a salesperson thinking about my deals. I would wake up in the middle of the night in a cold sweat and think, oh gosh, like, I'm talking to Jack, but he's not above the power line. He can't get the deal done. I know Zach is the guy who's going to sign the contract, but I don't even know if he knows that I exist. And I would spend all this time worrying about these things, right? And in reality, you just need to just be direct with the customer. I think salespeople sometimes forget you can be direct with the customer. You can ask direct questions. But particularly for like younger, newer salespeople, it can be hard to do that. And I think the humbling disclaimer is a tool that can unlock the, hey, here's a direct question that I'm asking to Jack, being like, hey, I feel sort of weird asking about this, but you know, usually when we're signing these deals, the COO is involved in some capacity. And I saw Zach as your COO. Would it be crazy for us to set up a call with him? And the idea here is like, I'm asking directly, I'm sort of softening the language, and it makes it easier for me to get that out. Some people have no problem being super direct. I struggle with it. And so that tool for me was one of those moments where I was like, I'm going to use that.
We do with our guys where they have to ask a tough question. Nicole gets them in the habit of doing it all the time. And like, I don't know, the more pathways that are built up in the brain, the more comfortable you feel in that setting of asking those questions. A great one for us is around when you've booked a meeting and you ask questions around, what do I do when you don't show up? You know, can I ask you a bit of a weird question other than an act of God? Is there any reason why you wouldn't be there?
Yeah.
Getting people in the habit of that, you tend to see that, especially in, you know, we're booking meetings on behalf of other companies. So the results, who shows up and when, we're often like led by that, so it's important that we challenge people. But yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's a great skill set. So this might be attacking the brand slightly here, Nick, but did you want to do this with your life?
Oh yeah, I did. So
always.
When I was in my freshman year of high school, so ninth grade, they had, I don't know if you guys have this in the UK, but in the US they have, most schools have what they call the morning announcements, which is before the first class of the day, there's like a 5-minute television broadcast by the school where it's like, you know, the art club is going to be meeting today at 2:15. Make sure to bring your paintbrushes. And everybody, the football team has a game later this evening. Make sure you come out and support them. It's just general announcements about activities and what's going on with the school. And usually students are the ones who are in front of the camera reading those messages and delivering them. And for me, I love getting to be in front of the camera. I love getting to be in front of the mic. I guess behind the mic might be what it really is. And so when I was in ninth grade, I like volunteered to be on the morning announcements. And I did that for 4 years all through through high school. And then that for me, like, I loved doing it. It energizes me so, so much. I actually love public speaking. I love sort of getting to be the focus of the thing. I like attention. And, you know, I remember when I went off to college, I guess you guys call it university, I told my mom, I want to be a TV anchor. And she said, well, you're not going to make any money doing that. And you're going to wake up at 2 a.m. every day. And I said, well, that doesn't sound very fun. So I ended up in this world of B2B sales. And I think now there is sort of a world emerging with like more, I don't know what you would call it, edutainment, I hear people call it, but I don't know. I love doing this. I'm having so much fun, to answer your question.
So I guess if we were to take away the element of sales, and I could wave a magic wand, and I could say, Nick, we're going to give you your own Tonight Show. and you're going to be adored by thousands and thousands of people, but you can never talk about sales again, and that's not your forte. You've got to talk about other things, and you've got to spend time with Ariana Grande and talk about her new single. Would you ditch sales forever and go down the road of fame and podcasting and presenting? Is that where your passion really lies?
No, I would continue to do this. There's two reasons. One, there's a really great essay. I forget the guy who wrote the essay, but it's been recommended by Tim Ferriss quite a bit. It's called 1,000 True Fans is the name of the essay. And the idea behind it is if you talk to your average person, they think, oh, I really want to be famous. I want everyone in the world to know who I am. And the reality is you actually don't want to be famous unless you're the person that likes getting interrupted every single time that you're trying to get a coffee. Being famous and having every single person, all of the lay people, the average people knowing you, is not actually the optimal outcome. The optimal outcome, the idea behind the essay is 1,000 True Fans, is you want to be famous with the right people. So it's much better to have 10,000 CEOs love your stuff and know who you are than 10 million random people know who you are. The idea is you want to be famous with the right sort of connections in your network. And that's not to dismiss folks who are not at a CEO level, but the idea is you want to cultivate the right network because that is really where things get exciting. And then you can also still have a personal life. And so, no, I don't think I would want to just be this late night TV host. I don't have a particular interest in pop culture, believe it or not. The other thing is I like talking about stuff that excites me and interests me. And so for me, the thing that I really love about sales is I love the psychological element of it. Like I'm very, very interested in the psychology of it. You know, if you go back to me being in ninth grade, being this dorky kid on the morning announcements, which I very much was, back then I even enjoyed reading books about psychology. And oftentimes, like, I like reading about logical fallacies and seeing where my own brain sort of tricks me and does me wrong. So, Jack, I don't think that'd be a very exciting life, although the interview with Ariana Grande I might enjoy. But other than that, no. I like selling. I mean, selling is hard, right? And I think that's there's sort of like this sick love-hate relationship that we have with it, because I was a wrestler in high school and college, and wrestling is like, it's a brutal, brutal sport. You get your shoulder cranked behind your neck, you get punched in the face on the mat, like you end up getting banged up and hurt. It's like, it's a fight. And for some reason, I still continue to go coach wrestling and work out. And like, I'm coaching at a university right now. I go and I'll wrestle with these guys. And the next day I'll have a black eye. And my friends will be like, why do you keep doing this? And it's like this love, hate. I feel like it makes you tougher. And there's something about knowing that you still have it in you. And so sales is sort of like that also. You get punched in the face. You get a black eye from the customer. Like, it's not easy. It is not easy, but I subscribe to the belief that if it were easy, everybody would do it. And I think in the long run, that makes you tougher and tougher and tougher, and you have a more fulfilling life from that.
Interesting. Okay, and Nick, we've kind of had a, I think I remember, and tell me if I'm completely wrong, I feel like one of the time we kind of maybe like clashed or kind of crossed paths, You were posting and you do some great content, and I love like the copyright on it as well. And I think you always like say like your opener, and I think you always used to put, "Hi, it's Nick here calling from ABC. How are you?" And then go into it. I believe that, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think you used to put, "How are you?" on your calls. And then as time's gone by from your content now, I believe you've removed the "How are you" question. Am I right in thinking that?
So I never have advocated for "how are you" or "did I catch you at a bad time." For me, when I open a cold call, Zach picks up the phone and he says, "Hello." My opener is, "Zach, this is Nick Sigelski with 30 Minutes to President's Club. I know you didn't expect me to call you this afternoon. Do you mind if I take 1 minute? I'll tell you what I'm calling about, and then you can tell me whether or not it makes sense for us to speak." That has always been my opener. And the intent behind it for me is, the most common questions that I would get on a cold call is, after any opener, if you open with "how are you" or "did I catch you to bedtime," is, well, who is this? Where are you calling from? Or what's this about? And then also in the person's mind is like, hey, like, I've got stuff I need to take care of. I don't want to be trapped on the phone call with a salesperson. You mentioned Sandler earlier. It's sort of an upfront contract in a way. Where I believe our opinions have differed, Jack, is your belief is what is the intent of including the name of who I am and the name of the company? And I actually have given that much, much thought. And I would actually tend to agree with you that it is not necessary. And we can talk about that if you would like. But that's always been, I think, where we disagreed for a while on LinkedIn.
Interesting. So obviously our thought process is that we don't. And there's probably, my name's Jack. I could say my name's Roger Rabbit or Marge Simpson.
Yep.
It's if you don't know me, you don't know me. It means shit. And then
yep.
I was saying there are pros, obviously. If I'm calling from Microsoft, well, it might carry a bit of clarity. If I say I'm calling from We Have a Meeting, chances are people aren't going to know at this point. So it's like all you're hearing is meeting. My brain would go meeting, outsource sales, booking meetings, shut it down. Do you know what I mean? So I guess there's the pro if you do have a bit of social proof. But your job is to kind of – you want to get into that conversation and deliver an upfront contract like you mentioned.
Yes.
And that's the same thing we do. It's a sales call. You can hang up or let me have 30 seconds. And then you've got that buy-in to kind of go into what the – and you can lead with problems. And it's a pattern interrupt. It's funny. But I guess from calling America, you might want to weigh in as well. People do ask, who is this? Why are you calling? It's like, well, no, that not always. And we have had some real success in the US, but I don't know why it's such an American thing to really know like where you're calling from, because it means nothing. If you're calling from a company, they're like, if you're calling strangers, you might be calling your ideal prospects that all follow you on LinkedIn who know about 30 minutes to President's Club. Cool, it makes complete sense. But on the other flip side, if you're just cold calling strangers that don't have a clue who you are, what value does it add?
I think one other thing that I want to point out is the first probably 6 seconds of the cold call, maybe like 6 to 12 seconds, the person is they're almost reorienting around the interaction that they're in right now. Because if you think about a cold call, when I pick up the phone to call Zach, and I keep picking on you, Zach, I'm prepared for that interaction. Because I am the one initiating that interaction. I know, all right, I'm about to make a cold call. So I'm ready. I'm on the dime. It's like, Zach, if somebody from the side threw a football at you right now, you'd be like, oh, shoot, I got to catch it, right? You have to sort of reorient to what's going on. And if you think about a cold call, the person's phone rings and they pick up the phone and they are not expecting a upfront contract cold call interaction. They actually have no idea what to expect. And so the first 6 to 12 seconds of that cold call, almost what you say is meaningless because their brain isn't processing it yet. And part of what your goal should be in the beginning of that call is to get them to accept, like sort of get their attention and get them to accept the interaction is my belief. And so I think the essential elements of opening a cold call is one, doing something different than what most salespeople do, which is they say, hey, you know, did I catch you at a bad time? Or how are you doing today, Jack? And if you're calling 47 CFOs that afternoon, you cannot honestly tell me that you care about the individual days of all of those CFOs. So you're already starting with this, like, you know, leading with dishonesty. It's not real. It's not, you can't tell me you care about all of those CFOs and their day right there when you're making a cold call. Your intent of that cold call is to get a meeting. And so that's why I hate, how are you doing? I think that's a terrible and dishonest way to open a cold call. So what your goal in the beginning is get their attention. I like you say, hey, this is a sales call. I've heard some funny ones where it's like, hey, my mother told, like literally they pick up and you say, hey, Jack, my mother told me anytime I'm interrupting somebody, I have to apologize. So I'm going to apologize. This is a sales call. Do you mind if I take 1 minute? I'll tell you what this is about and then you can hang up on me. Actually, there I didn't say my name or my company. So there's a variation of the permission-based opener. But I think the essential elements in the beginning of the cold call for me, get their attention, some sort of pattern interrupt, and it doesn't have to be anything fancy or as cheeky as what I just said. Acknowledge that it is indeed a cold call, because I think this is an area that a lot of salespeople trip up, is it should be abundantly clear to the other person that this is an unscheduled interaction and they don't know you, because that will help them orient around, all right, this is a cold call, and then maybe they'll hear your pitch out, and it actually makes it more effective when they understand it's a cold call, not oh, wait, have I spoken with this person before? You don't want their brain thinking about that. When their brain is thinking about, wait, do I know this person? Is this something I'm supposed to be prepared for? It actually shuts down the part of their brain that could listen to your pitch or your message. So I think you have to be very, very direct that this is indeed a cold call. The other bad outcome, if you're not direct with that, is you could get accused of dishonesty, and you never want to start the interaction on that place. So let them know right away that this is a sales call. And then I think the key for me here is you need to have a time-based ask that they can opt in or opt out of. And the reason for that is twofold. One, I think this is another Sandler thing. Like, there's the anxiety that the prospect has about, like, how long could this interaction go? And if you think about it, you're interrupting a COO, and she has 342 things on her to-do list. And if you are going to ramble and ramble and ramble, that's a really tough psychological place for the other person to be. And so when you have that time-based ask, whether it's 27 seconds or 1 minute or just a moment, I think it eases that anxiety for them and shows that you respect their time. Also, when you let them opt in or opt out, there is a difference between physically hearing someone and actually listening to what they have to say. And if you don't get them to opt in, then they might just physically hear your message and the wall is still up. And that's why you might get hit with the not interested or oh, we're all set or you know what, sorry, I don't take sales calls. When you get them to say, all right, fine, you've got a minute. Now you have an opportunity to give them the pitch and their, I think, logical brain will listen to it rather than the emotional pushback. I don't know if I answered your question at all, Jack. I just went down a road with that one.
It was very interesting. I liked how cheeky you were with that pattern interrupt. Zach, do you want to weigh in? I could see you itching when you saw him mention logical and emotional brain, so I'm sure you've got
it's
some.
A big part of our training and approach and everything that we do. We're very emotion based on a cold call. The entire interaction, yep. There's no I mean, maybe you'll differ from us hearing it because of your software background, but we don't really mention anything about systems or API. Yep. We mention no technical language in that initial cold call. It's just about, do you have symptoms of this problem?
Yep.
And then kind of testing the motivation to fix it and more of like a challenging pushback on it than anything. We only get into kind of technical conversation later on down the line. One thing that I did want to ask you while we were talking then, because you're super passionate, like I can tell straight away you come across like that. And it just reminded me of when I got into sales, I was recommended to listen to Jordan Belfort, Straight Line Persuasion. And there's a bit on that about you can basically come across so enthusiastic that people just want to buy stuff and they find you addictive and want to get to know you. I found the opposite in this country, that we don't like that. Do you find that that's a thing that works really well in America, but perhaps wouldn't work elsewhere?
So I'll answer your question. I actually want to point to the thing that you just said earlier about like attacking the symptom and not getting into the technical stuff, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. I think most salespeople should take their value proposition and dump it. I was looking for a trash can, but it's out of reach. Dump it right in the trash. I believe in what I call a problem proposition. On the cold call, you should be attacking the problems. You said you called them symptoms. Attack the problems that you solve. Bring up the problems that you solve. Don't say anything about how you solve them or what you do. And the second you say, oh, our company is the leading provider of, you know, sales meetings for like, no, you're dead. Yeah. You have to attack the problem. And then, like you said, test their willingness to solve said problem. Because it doesn't make sense to say, hey, here's the solution, until you understand, okay, they actually have that problem and they're actually interested to some degree in solving said problem. Most salespeople skip those two steps. So make sure, like, bring up the problem you solve, figure out, does that problem exist for them? Do they have any interest in solving said problem? And then you can basically close the call by saying, like, hey, that's exactly what we're designed to help with. Look, I know I'm calling you totally out of the blue. Do you have some time to connect later this week? And I can share more about what this does. I usually will close with, like, do you have some time to learn more when I'm not totally cold calling you out of the blue, right? Like, I'll sort of insert, maybe not that dorky of a laugh, but, like, the idea is, like, I know I'm calling you out of the blue. You told me I had this problem. You told me you sort of want to solve the problem. We are specifically designed to solve said problem. Would you like to learn more? That's it. Let them opt in or opt out. And then if they lean really in hard and say, hey, how, what do you do, what do you do, what do you do, you can share a little bit. But I think you want to have a scheduled interaction where you can prepare and they can prepare also. And I think a lot of salespeople forget that. So agree with you on that front. Your other question that I totally, my brain dropped.
Let me ask it again.
Yeah.
So basically the difference in tonality.
Oh, I remember it. It's the enthusiasm. No, yeah. I agree with you. I think that if you come across as enthusiastic as I am right now about cold calling when you're pitching your thing, you're going to have the other person put their guard up. I think you come across as like, look, the fact of the matter is most of us are not selling like the Fountain of Youth or some miracle ointment that totally changes somebody's life. Like, dude, I was selling accounting software to law firms. And if I come in and be like, this is totally going to change your world, Zach. It's going to completely re-engineer every workflow you've ever had. It's like, dude, you're selling accounting. You're selling, you know, payment processing software. Like, and you're selling to someone who is in my world was far, far my senior. Like, I'm selling to you know, a 63-year-old CFO of a big law firm. And I think you have to respect that person, if you're all the way up like crazy enthusiastic, like that's just not where they are. And you actually come across as a bit cloying. And so I think you want to be enthusiastic and believe in what you sell. But if you come over the top, it comes across quite salesy, in my opinion.
No, that's a really good point. Okay. And I guess, like, for somebody, obviously you've been in sales for like a long, long time, Nick. And when you started, I'm sure that it was a huge learning experience. What was probably like the first roadblock that you came across in terms of your development, and how did you overcome that?
I think most salespeople, like, if you actually look at success in sales, let me answer that in a different way. In the beginning, it's really, really hard to get initial traction. Part of how you learn in sales is by doing it again and again and again, by actually getting deals, like getting meetings booked and getting deals to completion. And if you're a brand new novice salesperson, let's just use a cold call as a micro interaction we're going to focus on here. If I'm a brand new BDR and I don't know how to open a cold call, I have no skills at all, I've been handed, hey, here's your territory, here's the CRM, here's your phone, like, here's what we do, here's the problem proposition, you sort of have your script, and you get calling, but you don't know how to open a cold call. You don't know either the words that you should be saying, or like really the tone or way that you should be saying them, and you make 100 cold calls, and you get hung up on 99 of them. One, it's going to be super, super discouraging, but then two, you've not given yourself an opportunity to actually use your problem proposition or value proposition in the heat of battle, or you've never had an opportunity to like actually practice closing out the call. Now you can do those things with your colleagues, but, and you can practice offline, but it's different. And so I think the beginning, the hardest part for most salespeople is that first probably 18 months where you're sort of just stumbling and fumbling and failing. And it certainly was the case for me. I remember, you know, crying on my bike as I rode home from work in my first sales job. I'm like, man, this isn't for me. This sucks. This stinks. And so I think it's that sort of first 18 months to get through. And so for me, I'll tell you the thing that made the biggest difference for me, and it's part of the reason I post about it a lot, was that permission-based opener on a cold call. And even though I, in the beginning, came across super, super static, it was like, Jack, this is Nick Sigelski with 30 Minutes to President's Club, by getting that piece down right, people were actually letting me give a chance to give my pitch, and I got to test things. And so I think the things for a salesperson to nail, let's say you're a new AE, I think that you got to nail is, one, how do you open a cold call? Figure out the words that you're going to say. Like, you know, use my approach, or use Zach's approach, or use Jack's approach. Find something that actually works and just stick with that. Even if you only have a 80% success rate and somebody over there has a 92% success rate, you're high enough that marginal difference, don't worry about chasing like the small efficiency gain. Pick a good opener and nail that. Then figure out how you're going to explain the thing that you do. That's where most salespeople stumble and fumble. Well, we're the leading provider of X, or we help companies Y. That's not it. Like, you should not be the subject of your pitch. The prospect should be. Said differently, you're not the hero of solving the problem. Your customer is the hero of solving the problem, and you're just a tool that they use to do that. You're just something that they use to do that. So figure out how can you explain your thing in that context where the prospect is the hero and you are simply a tool to do it. I think if you nail those two things, you're in a much, much better place. And then the other area I think a lot of salespeople struggle, and I certainly did, is like, how do you run your sales day? What's the battle rhythm? You know, you're a Jeb Blunt fan, regardless of how you say it. He talks about like the battle rhythm of how you run your day. And I think most salespeople, they chase these endless distractions and they spend hours researching the competition or having one-on-ones with their peers to talk about best practices or learning more about their solution. And they do those things in lieu of actually picking up the phone and making their cold calls and actually working their deals. And so I think the other thing to reorient around to be successful as a salesperson is the first, like the big two that you should be spending your time on are creating new pipeline, aka prospecting, and advancing current pipeline, aka working your deals, getting them closer to close, or getting them to a point where you and the prospect agree, hey, this isn't a fit, and getting them out of your pipeline. All of those other things, which are important, don't get me wrong, researching the competition, learning about your product, those should be done after you've taken care of the big two, but they cannot come at the expense of your prospecting, of your working your pipeline. And most salespeople invert it because the prospecting is hard. And so they would rather spend hours coming up with a new sales deck versus ripping 100 dials in a week. And I think those are the big three things that I would do. Nail your opener, nail how you explain your thing, figure out how you're going to run your sales day. Do those things right, and the success will come.
See, Jack, you do agree with Nick now, don't you?
I agree
with
him.
There's a lot of stuff you agree on here.
I knew we'd meet up and I'd be like, I was wrong. I like Nick's again. I'm not saying it anymore. I think you're one of the things that I was doing some training today with some new guys, and it was like one of the things is obviously our job as an outbound agency is this is what we do. We just hit the phone. So it's no like time for distractions. There's no time for call reluctancy. Someone can't come in and be like, oh, I just want to focus on this first. It's like, no, that's the job, black and white. When you get thrown into it and they say, and I remember my first sales jobs, and it's like, well, here's the yellow pages and there's a phone, like go and call people. And it's like, that's absolutely fine. But it's like, oh, well, where do I go? What do I do? This is like a little bit of confusion. The biggest thing is actually having that time to prospect. And I know that I've seen you guys speak about it as well. It's like what you do now, you'll reap the rewards over the next 90 days. It's making sure. And me and Zach have had conversations about this even recently. It's looking at my calendar in a day. And sometimes, and I imagine that people get in contact with you being somebody on LinkedIn that's like a bit of a sales kind of, can I call you a sales guru? Will you be offended if I call you that?
You can call me whatever you want, Jack. You can call me whatever you want. I might not accept the title.
Don't give me an open pass. but it's one of those that is like, I'm sure people get in touch and be like, I'd love to pick your brains. I'd love to have 20 minutes with you. I'd love you to come on my podcast. And it's like, if I said yes to all of these, I'm never going to spend time like generating revenue. So you look through your calendar and be like, fuck, I've agreed to meet two people at the back end of the day, but actually that's not important. What is going to generate revenue for me, for the company, for all of us? Okay, that's important. Actually, going for a coffee to build a relationship for half an hour, it's not relevant. I mean, in the long run, I get that there's a time and a place, but how do you do it now in terms of being precious with your time? Because I'm sure you get bombarded. I know you ignored my DMs for quite a while. So you must be busy.
I know. I did ignore you. I hurt Jack's feelings. He needed to get it out for this therapy session. I think what I typically won't do is like I won't go on someone's podcast if they haven't started the show yet. And like they'll say, hey, I'm planning on launching this show. Will you come on as one of our first guests? And I admire people that are taking the leap and doing those things. The fact of the matter is I think most podcasts fizzle out after like 5 or 6 episodes if you actually look at the data. And so I want to come, like, my goal is to impact as many people as possible. My goal is to make the widest and deepest impact possible. And you don't do that by coming on a podcast that 10 people listen to every single month. That's just not how it works. And so it doesn't come from like, oh, I don't like this person or I'm not interested in helping this person on their journey, but it comes from a, like, that doesn't necessarily align with what I'm hoping to achieve. I'm still not great at it. I think the way that I do it, Jack, is, you know, if somebody reaches out to ask for my time, I'll try to get as much upfront information from them as possible. Like, what is their intent for the call? Like, if they want to meet with me, if they want to have that coffee chat, like, Like, I want to understand, like, what do they want to accomplish? And I'll usually ask it in a way, like, if you just say, hey, what do you want to accomplish? They're like, I just wanted to meet you, right? And so, like, that doesn't really give you the information. And so usually what I'll say is, like, hey, I want to make sure I'm as prepared as possible for our meeting or our interaction. Like, is there anything that would be helpful for me to prepare so we can have the most impactful discussion possible? And that usually, because it's, you're sort of invoking that rule of reciprocity where it's like, oh, this person actually is going to prepare. That can be the way that you figure out, what do they really want out of me? From the pick the brain perspective. The other thing that I'll do is, like, when somebody asks to pick your brain, like, I'll try to shift to asynchronous sometimes. Like, somebody reached out to me recently. They're an attorney that I used to work with at a past company, and he says, hey, I'm preparing a podcast agreement for one of my clients. I'm just hoping to learn more about, like, the podcast space so that I can put together that agreement. Can I ask you some questions? And I'm like, I want to help this person because this person helped me a lot in the past, but I don't think we need to get on a live call. I'm going to respond and say, why don't you just send me the questions you have, and I'll send you a voice memo later when I'm like, I'm going for a walk. And so I think that's one strategy. Yeah. And then sometimes you just have to say no, and you can use your humbling disclaimer. You can say, hey, I feel really uncomfortable. Like, I wish I could say yes to everything. I really do. I wish I had 82 hours in a day, but I don't. And right now this is not a focus. And if you want to check back, you know, please do. But right now I can't do this.
That's fair. And you did say yes to us, and you're sat here now. Josh Brawn.
It's only because of that boxing pick, man. No, it's because I read your stuff too, and, like, you actually know what you're talking about too. If you, we came on and you said, Nick, so what is sales?
Next question, Nick. Right, Nick, thank you so much for coming here. Before we wrap up, I guess you're doing some great things in the space, and you are influencing others and helping people that are coming into it. So I guess you've not left sales, but you've left the classic, whatever it is, 7 till 7 of sales. So yep. 30 minutes to President's Club, and then what? What's next?
You know, I get asked this question a lot, and what I don't do is have, like, a 5-year goal and a 10-year goal. I think right now my focus is, we have between 80 and 100,000 people download the show every single month. And if you compare that number to how many salespeople exist in the U.S. alone, that is a tiny, tiny percentage of all of the salespeople that are out there. And so I think it's easy for me to say, oh, we've had some success. Let me go do something else. Let me go chase this shiny object or that shiny object. But the fact of the matter is, like, we have really just started. And, you know, somebody that I really look up to is John Barrows. And something that I hear John talk about time and time again is elevating the profession of sales. And still, if I go to a party, or I go to the, you guys call it the pub, I'd call it the bar, like, and somebody says, oh, well, what do you do? And I say, I work in sales. They're like, oh, you know what I mean? Like, there's still sort of that stigma. And I think this is a profession that we should be proud of, because this conversation we've had the last 40 minutes, like, we've talked about some, like, deep psychological principles. And if somebody has actually made it through this full interview, hopefully they learn some things. And, like, I think the best salespeople take really seriously their profession and the craft and the professional development. And this isn't something that should be looked down upon, because it's hard work. And we're in the business of helping our customer achieve the optimal outcome, regardless of whether or not our solution is part of that. Now, that doesn't mean that I spend 42 hours with someone who's never going to buy from me, right? Go find the optimal outcome with somebody else. But I think there's a misconception about what really, really great salespeople do and how to be a really, really great salesperson. And so I'd like to impact as many people as possible via that. I'd also like to make some money via that. Don't get me wrong. But no, I'm not going to keep chasing random shiny objects. I don't think you'll see me release a course on LinkedIn anytime soon. My goal is to, I think, impact as many people and help change the perception of the profession of sales. Hopefully that wasn't too surface level of an answer, Jack.
No, that was beautiful. I told you you'd like him, Zach. Right, thank you, Nick. It's been absolutely amazing. Lovely to actually meet you in the flesh as well. I think you've cleared some great information, and I think anybody listening, there are some really strong takeaways on how to improve, and I think it's an enjoyable conversation. You're very enthusiastic and full of energy, and I can see why your podcast is performing so well. So Nick, thank you so much for joining us. For anybody that wants to check you guys out or your podcast, where can we find you if it's not down at the local wrestling club?
So you can find me on LinkedIn. My first name's easy. It's N-I-C-K. The last name's a little trickier. It's C-E-G-E-L-S-K-I. And I accept every single LinkedIn connection request, except the ones where you're trying to sell me Bitcoin. Those are the ones I usually reject. So find me on LinkedIn, and then you can also listen to me more if you like the sound of my voice, which God help you if you do, on 30 Minutes to President's Club.
Nick Kogelski, thank you so much.
Our books are now open. Friends, Romans, countrymen, if you're looking for more sales, and that might be getting more meetings in the diary, meeting more of the right types of people, or breaking into a new area or sector, we've got you covered in two key ways. Number one, we can do it for you. We can kick the doors down, get you the meetings, and do the prospecting that you hate. Or number two, we can teach you how we do it so you can do it for yourselves, creating repeatable, predictable results. So if you're interested in either of those things, www.wehaveameeting.com and hit the contact us form. Speak to you soon.